Back now with Day to Day and something to whet your Thanksgiving appetite. This is the story of Man Bites World. It's a blog written by 26-year-old Noah Galutin. Noah lives here in Southern California, home to thousands of ethnic restaurants. Earlier this year, he devised this challenge for himself: eat the cuisine of a different country every day. On day one, he took on Mexico.
Mexico is sort of the cuisine that's been with me my whole life. It's sort of every step of my gastronomic evolution. You know, whether it's you're a kid and you're having quesadillas and nachos, you know, when you're growing up and you start having, you know, cowhead tacos and things like that.
Yes, Noah is a brave eater. He'll eat cowhead tacos and just about anything else, and then he'll write about it on his blog. Man Bites World is his online chronicle of this culinary journey around the world. I joined him on day 70 at Azeen's Afghani restaurant in Pasadena.
Delicious.
Yeah,
thank,
really
you.
Good, thank you.
Over cups of hot cardamom tea, Noah explained the parameters of his quest to eat food from all over the world, starting with rule number one: no cooking for himself.
That's not going to be very indicative of the cuisine, you know, stealing someone else's recipe online and doing a bad job recreating it. You know, I can't order stuff from online, canned fish or something, and have that sent to me. And really just, you know, the main one is, you know, no days off.
And with this, the first course arrives.
Alrighty. Oh, wow. Here we have the chef's combo.
Our waitress, Leticia Ruiz, brings us a plate piled high with Afghan appetizers.
Okay, here we have mantu, which is a steamed dumpling stuffed with lamb and onions topped with yogurt and vegetables. And over here we have sambosa, which is chickpeas and ground lamb.
There's a bit of a science to this. Noah carefully photographs each plate to post on his blog. He takes extensive notes, and then comes the fun part.
This is, I think, the battered eggplant with yogurt and meat sauce on top. So it looks appropriately crispy and creamy and meaty. And so let's see. As promised, it's really, really good. It sort of reminds me of Italian eggplant dishes I had a lot growing up. Like, my grandmother's Sicilian, so I grew up eating a lot of Italian food.
You hear a lot of people say that food is a way to get to know a culture. Do you get a sense when you go to these places and you sit down and have a meal, do you feel like you actually get to learn anything more about the country that it's from?
Yeah, absolutely. And also, I mean, you look at, I mean, food literally is a country's history. It's when you look at, you know, poor people finding ways to make cheap cuts of meat delicious. And that's where cooking comes from. And that's where great cooking comes from.
Noah has been at this for nearly 3 months now. And though the okra stew from Ghana was nothing like the sweetbreads from Argentina, he has found that food, no matter where it's from, has some universal themes.
Comfort food is one of the most amazing subplots of all of this, because it's amazing how certain cuisines really do translate instantly and fairly universally. I mean, Ethiopian food, pretty much everyone that's ever tried it, I've found it, likes it. There are many people who try Ethiopian food and go, oh, that stinks. There's no reason that Ethiopian food should necessarily be accessible to, you know, somebody who grew up at Olive Garden. But people enjoy it, and that's really interesting to me.
That was delicious.
Oh, thank you.
Really good.
Yeah.
Really.
How do you like the sauce?
Really good, yeah.
Our appetizer plate wiped clean. Leticia brings on more dishes, a savory sautéed butternut squash, cauliflower stewed with tomatoes and onions, and an entree that looks like a beautiful orange-colored bird's nest.
This is actually kabili palau. It's actually a basmati rice. What they do is they sear it in lamb sauce to make it brown, and then it has the raisins and carrots on top.
It is delicious. But as we eat, Noah tells me not all of his meals have turned out this well.
I had a pretty abysmal cow foot stew at this Jamaican place. I mean, one of the worst things I've had, honestly, so far is overcooked chicken. People are terrified of getting sick, I guess, so they destroy the lovely bird by overcooking it. And, you know, I'd rather eat cow foot stew than really dry chicken.
In addition to bad bird, Noah has also faced the issue of abundance. How do you choose one Chinese restaurant in all of Los Angeles? Noah didn't. On day 73, he and a group of his friends tackled 11 Chinese places in 11 hours. As you can imagine, all this eating takes a caloric toll. Luckily, Noah seems to have the kind of speedy metabolism you need to do this sort of thing. Even so, there are days when this quest is a lot to stomach.
Because, you know, a lot of times you are having the specialties of a country, and sometimes I was having Bulgarian food. So what's the typical side for this? That's really, you know, something that you'd recommend as a nice typical side. And he goes, French fries with cheese on top. And I'm like, all right, you know, you got to get it. You got to go for it. But I was really hoping he'd say salad that day. Didn't work out that way.
There are other challenges in finding a different country's cuisine to dine on every day. Even in Southern California, it's tough locating a place that serves fare from Uzbekistan or Mozambique.
Amazingly, Scotland and Wales are really difficult. New Zealand is kind of difficult, although now I have some options for that.
Noah has received some help. Readers of his blog have chimed in with their recommendations. A few have even invited him over to cook him food from their homelands. But back to Afghanistan and our lunch.
So I'm going to give you... That way you could share.
Though we are both feeling full, how can you resist dessert, a pudding made with almonds and rose water?
Wow, this is thick and wobbly. Here you go.
Thank you.
This is a very white, creamy concoction with pistachios on top, and I'm excited to give it a try. Mm. Oh, wow. Yeah, it's the rose water makes it sort of like...
It's like eating a garden.
What you thought eating potpourri would be like when you were a kid.
But tasty.
Yeah.
It's days like this that Noah imagines he could keep up his blog for a long, long time. But the world is only so large. There are only so many countries he can conquer.
So how will you know when this is truly done?
When it's, I go through a full day and haven't been able to find anything new to eat the whole day, then that's it. I mean, you know, the sun is down, it's 11:45 at night, and you go, all right, I guess that's it. You pop in a frozen dinner and have a glass of wine and call it a night.
But at least for now, the journey goes on. Today is day 85, American. Noah Galutin will be eating a proper Thanksgiving dinner at home. To see photos from our meal and read Noah's blog, go to our website, npr.org. Day to Day is a production of NPR News with contributions from Slate.com. I'm Alex Cohen. Happy Thanksgiving.
Of course, turkey is a powerful symbol on Thanksgiving, and that can be problematic for people who usually eat vegetables instead of meat. NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports.
Wayne Pacelli is head of the Humane Society of the United States. He's a vegan, which means he eats no animal products. But when he goes to spend Thanksgiving with his family...
There will be some turkey that others eat, and there's nothing I can do about that.
Most vegetarians are used to this kind of social situation. Meat is everywhere. But Thanksgiving is a little different.
You know, I don't think there's any other American holiday that is quite so associated with killing an animal for the table.
Pacelli says a roasted animal carcass isn't tempting for people like him who are committed to vegetarianism. But he says...
You know, there is a large category of people who are eating less meat than they used to, called flexitarians. And I'm sure that among that group of people, this may be a day where they choose to eat some meat.
Flexitarians are part of a growing trend of people generally thinking harder about meat, whether or not to eat it, and if so, what kind is okay. Turkeys can wander around a roomy pasture at Springfield Farm in Sparks, Maryland. Every November, hundreds of people come here to pick up their holiday meal.
I'm David Smith, the owner of Springfield Farm.
And can you tell me sort of what your typical customers are?
I think it's more the issue of people looking to connect with their food, to put a face on it, if you will. Their concerns are local, what the livestock is fed. They want it as natural as possible, and how the livestock is treated, not only on the farm, but also how it's slaughtered.
Those kinds of concerns are why some people just won't eat mass-produced meat.
I stopped eating meat not because I'm against devouring it, but because I didn't like where it was coming from.
That's Jenna Wogenrich. She lives on a small farm in Vermont. She's written a new book called Made from Scratch that describes how she grows her own vegetables.
I've been a vegetarian for over half a decade.
At her family's Thanksgiving, she usually eats tofu instead of meat. But this year, she decided to prepare for the holiday by raising her own turkey. She bought a little bird. He soon became a big white one.
Well, I didn't name him. I made sure I didn't name him. And he was great. I mean, he got along great with the chickens and with all the other farm animals.
She drove him to a nearby farm to have him killed and stored his body in her freezer. But then she ran into a problem. She says some meat-eating members of her family didn't want to consume a known animal.
The turkey situation was a big lesson for me because you go into it way, way too self-righteous. There's a whole spectrum to this, and there's a million different viewpoints, even within one family.
She ended up trading the turkey with someone who agreed to teach her dog to herd sheep. I called up the Farm Sanctuary in New York State. It's a farm animal protection group that runs animal shelters for livestock, plus an Adopt-a-Turkey project. Tricia Berry works there. I asked her what she thought about people who call themselves vegetarians but still plan to eat animals on special occasions.
Who am I to judge or criticize someone for, you know, their journey and their path, whatever it might be?
After all, she says, she herself went through a period of cutting back on meat. But she didn't quit cold turkey until she actually met a turkey, a bird called Cinnamon.
And I actually gave her a belly rub, and she rested into my hand, and I felt, you know, this living, breathing, alive turkey breast.
It reminded her of another turkey breast, the one she'd cooked for Thanksgiving the year before. She says that was the moment when she knew she had to switch from eating less meat to eating no meat. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep. In your health today, the dilemma of being nearly vegetarian on Thanksgiving. First, we'll examine an old myth. It's the myth that the amino acid in turkey, tryptophan, makes you sleepy. There's also the notion that this same compound may make you more trusting and cooperative. We wanted to know if there was any truth to that, so we brought in NPR's Allison Aubrey.
Sometimes the stories we tell ourselves have a way of becoming true. Take the turkey makes you sleepy tale.
I think personal experience indicates that, yes, it's true.
Holiday travelers Catherine Newberry and Robin McAdams, who I caught up with in Washington's Union Station, say they're pretty certain.
Eating a lot of turkey does seem to make a lot of people tired.
But wait a second. Couldn't it just be, as traveler Marianne Burke suggests, the Thanksgiving feast gorge factor?
I think it's true that any time you fill your plate four times and lay down on the couch, you're going to fall asleep.
Burke's explanation is right on, according to scientists. Overeating makes you sluggish. Add a little wine, and the mood gets very mellow very quickly. So why, if the explanation is so simple, does the story about tryptophan persist? Martha Stepanek is a professor of molecular nutrition at Cornell University. When I called to get her thoughts on the matter,
I said, oh, that same old story again. But it keeps popping up. I think it is based on a little bit of correct information, but misunderstood and misapplied.
The basic skinny is this. All foods that are protein-rich, everything from turkey to tofu, dairy products, nuts, and virtually all meats, contain a bunch of amino acids, roughly 20 of them. And one of these amino acids is tryptophan.
There's nothing unique about turkey and its tryptophan content.
It contains about as much as other meats. So if there were a direct sleepy effect, we'd feel it with all protein. So here's the next interesting wrinkle. Once tryptophan enters the body, it becomes the building block or precursor molecule of serotonin and melatonin, two brain compounds involved in regulating mood and sleep. In lab studies, when scientists jack up people's tryptophan levels by giving them supplements of purified tryptophan, they sometimes see changes in behavior. A surge of tryptophan can alter sleep and perhaps levels of cooperation, too. Take one study by British scientist Robert Rogers of Oxford. He documented what happens when players engage in games of prisoner's dilemma. In this game, you can either compete with your opponent to try to win everything, or you can cooperate and divide the reward. Rogers says tryptophan-deprived players were significantly less likely to cooperate.
I was surprised by the magnitude of the effect.
So this takes us back to the Thanksgiving dinner table. Surely, if loads of purified tryptophan delivered in lab studies can produce such effects, can't a turkey feast do the same? Not exactly, explains Stepanek.
If you feed people a high protein-containing diet, you don't get changes in brain tryptophan or serotonin.
So here's the rub. It basically boils down to a little traffic jam at the blood-brain barrier. Remember how we said that protein-rich foods like turkey contain about 20 amino acids? Well, after a meal, all of these amino acids are competing to get from the bloodstream to the brain. Researcher Simon Young of McGill University says think of it as a revolving door.
And if you imagine you're a tryptophan molecule, you want to get through that door. If there are more other people around, those are the other amino acids, it takes longer for you to get in.
So it turns out there is no surge of tryptophan to the brain after eating turkey or any other protein. Having heard the evidence, Robin McAdams has a new theory about the post-Thanksgiving feast letdown.
Maybe it's because I'm around my family, so I just want to sleep.
Not a bad theory. Food anthropologist Christine Dubois says the social interactions of the holidays may trump specific chemical changes brought on by food.
Here we are thinking that some substance is going to alter our destinies instead of thinking about how the way we treat people and interact with people is so paramount.
Americans, she says, just seem to love creating stories about the power of food. Alison Aubrey, NPR News, Washington.
Mitzi Tom means let's eat in one Native American dialect, so it's a good word to learn today. Mitzi Tom also happens to be the name of the cafe at Washington, D.C.'s National Museum of the American Indian. NPR's Netta Ulaby talked with chefs there about its Thanksgiving carryout menu.
Mitzi Tom's food is inspired by Native American ingredients. Think fire pit roasted salmon from the Pacific Northwest, buffalo chili from the plains. Sous chef Nate Ochter says the staff begins with tribal culinary traditions from all over the Americas and gives them a gourmet spin.
We do different mole sauces. So right now we have a vanilla and cinnamon mole with braised chicken, and then we have a citrus and sage mole for beef.
Yeah, we're always pushing the bar here.
Executive chef Bruce Barnes says the cafe first prepared an indigenous-inspired Thanksgiving meal just for museum staff. But the maple brine turkey with oyster stuffing proved so popular, Mitzi Tom offered it as a carryout 2 years ago. Now the cafe provides such fixings as scarlet runner bean salad, blue cornbread, and more.
In American lore, I mean, when you think about Thanksgiving, you think about the first Thanksgiving with the contributions that the Native Americans gave the first settlers. I think that just kind of adds a little bit of relevance to the takeout here.
Of course, this takeout is not easy to get your hands on unless you live around Washington, D.C. So Barnes and Ochter whipped up some savory apple pumpkin soup in the Mitzi Tom kitchen. The recipe's on NPR's website. It begins with hot oil and some onions.
And some turnips.
So right now you're stirring together the...
Stirring together the onions and the turnips, just getting a little caramelization on them. We just want to sweat the onions. Not too much color. The color comes into play where we roast the pumpkin and the squash in the oven and the apples in the oven as well.
You use crab apples.
Yeah, crab apples, yeah.
So tart.
They are. But, I mean, that acidity provides a nice balance with the richness of the different squashes that we use.
Those squashes could have been blue hubbard, calabaza, or turban. But for this soup, Ochter chose sweet pumpkin and buttercup.
Squash is a staple in Native American cooking. You know, you got the three sisters, beans, corn, and squash.
Now, can you tell me, did the Native Americans actually eat pumpkin soup?
Actually, probably not.
Mitzi Tom executive chef Bruce Barnes says what they did do was roast squash whole in the fire and scoop out the luscious innards. Sous chef Nate Ochter went for a similar effect by pureeing the soup in a blender. The result is a thick, smooth, mustard-colored soup, brightened by specks of apple, sage, chervil, and thyme.
Keeping with the native foods, we're going to be finishing the soup with a little bit of hazelnut oil and then garnishing it with a little bit of a saguaro cactus seed on top.
These cactus seeds definitely have a sweet flavor to them.
Now, what are they? I've never seen these.
These are saguaro cactus seeds from the Tohono O'odham tribe in the southwest.
They're very similar in taste and texture to almost a poppy seed.
Mmm, it is really fabulous. Wow.
We like to play with real products. And you'd be surprised that the people actually will come in here and will experiment and will eat these products.
Last time we had frog legs on the menu, we were selling about 50 pounds a week.
Apparently, woodland tribes are as keen on frog legs as the French. After Thanksgiving, Bruce Barnes has big plans for the South America part of the menu.
We're actually getting ready to experiment with cuyo.
Which is what?
Which is a guinea pig. which is a staple of the people of Ecuador and of El Salvador and Peru. A lot of people have the reaction that you just had, but it's a main staple, a main ingredient that they use in their culture.
People come here and they may reach outside their safety zone and say, hey, I want to be a part of the past, I want to be a part of this tradition, I want to be a part of, and I want to see what it tastes like.
Yeah.
I like to think of myself as an open-minded eater, but I think I'm going to stick to the pumpkin soup. Leave the guinea pig.
The kuya? Oh, my.
The Mitzi Tom Cafe at the National Museum of the American Indian is the only Zagat-rated cafe in the Smithsonian Institution. It's one of D.C.'s best-kept culinary secrets. Or it was. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.